Welcome to Native America Calling. I'm Sean Spruce. Joint replacement surgery, particularly for knees and hips, is among the most common medical procedures in the U.S. Numerous studies show the vast majority of people who get the surgery report significant improvements in pain, function, and overall health. We'll learn about what Native Americans facing joint replacement surgery should consider, and we'll talk about benefits and barriers of joint health. The conversation starts after the news.
This is National Native News. I'm Jill Freitas, sitting in for Antonia Gonzalez. On the Ute Mountain Ute Reservation, the tribe has started a project to open one of the largest solar farms in the United States. Clark Adamitis has more.
2.2 million solar panels, 8 miles long and 1 mile wide. That's the dimensions of the proposed Sun Bear Solar Farm just south of Toyoak, Colorado, in the heart of the Ute Mountain Ute Reservation. Scott Klo, the Ute Mountain Ute Environmental Programs Director, says the solar farm will be one of the top five largest solar farms in the United States.
It is a commercial scale project on the order of 756 megawatts AC power.
Planning has been ongoing for 2.5 years, and funding is coming from international renewable energy company Canagu. According to Canagu's director, Justin Passfield, the project will cost over $1 billion. Passfield says electricity generated from the solar farm will be connected to the Western Area Power Administration line, but it's unclear what regional entities the electricity will be sold to.
We're thinking about the power needs within Colorado, but also it makes sense for not to transmit power too far from where you are. Having said that, we're going to be producing a large amount of power, so I'm not sure that all of it will be able to be consumed within Colorado.
We as Ute Mountain Ute Tribe have been a fossil fuel tribe with oil and gas for a long time, probably over 50 years.
The Ute Mountain Ute Tribe's chairman, Manuel Hart, is excited about the opportunity for the tribe to become a major player in renewable energy.
And today, with the changes in legislation and global warming and climate change, you can see the impact of what's happening to our world. So renewable is the new future right now.
Canagu Group says the solar farm will create over 500 local jobs for electricians and laborers, and they're aiming to start producing electricity in 2026 once final approval is given from the Bureau of Indian Affairs. For KSUT and KSJD, I'm Clark Adamitis.
The Bodaway Gap region of Tuba City, Arizona, will have their own healthcare center after 20 years. TCRHCC will have a groundbreaking ceremony Friday for a new two-story healthcare facility and is expected to be completed in the fall of 2025. When completed, the center will offer services such as a primary care center, dental clinic, eye clinic, wellness center, mental health clinic, and more. Residents of Bodaway have had to travel 35 miles for healthcare services at the Tuba City Regional Healthcare Center in Tuba City. In 2018, TCRHCC established a limited services part-time clinic out of a mobile building. The need for services started in 2002 when a request was made by the communities of Bodaway, Gap, and Kaibato for a health facility. In a statement, TCRHCC CEO Joette Walters said, quote, "This is a historic event for the surrounding communities, and it all started with a vision to improve access to healthcare," end quote. Further event information will be provided on the TCRHCC website at www.tchealth.org. The Aleutic Museum in Kodiak, Alaska, has released a set of instructions for making an Aleutic snowfalling parka. This project was supported by the Tongarnak Native Village and the U.S. Bureau of Indian Affairs. Produced in partnership with Elder Susan Malutin, the resources provided step-by-step instructions for creating a long, hoodless coat from fabric. The garment is styled like the iconic Kodiak Aleutic snowfalling parka worn by both men and women. The resources are intended to help Aleutic people create cultural garments to share and celebrate their heritage. Education Manager Lita Buthin is leading the project. I'm Jill Freitas.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support by VisionMaker Media, envisioning a world changed and healed by understanding Native stories and the public conversations they generate. 45 plus years of Native stories and Indigenous knowledge through film and media can be found at visionmakermedia.org. Skugtash. For more than 40 years, Ramona Farms has revived ancient traditional foods, tepary beans, pinoli, polentas, and more, all from store.ramonafarms.com. Ramona Farms supports this show. Omnye.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
This is Native America Calling. I'm your host, Sean Spruce. For people who suffer from deteriorated cartilage or bone at the knee or hip due to injury, disease, or years of wear and tear, walking and doing normal activities can be painful. When that's the case, it might be time to visit a doctor to see if joint replacement surgery is recommended. Numerous studies over the years show joint replacement surgery offers better movement and less pain in the vast majority of cases. But it's an option that Native Americans don't take advantage of at the same rate as everyone else. One reason might be the prospect of traveling long distances for care. In this hour, we'll talk with orthopedic specialists about joint health. As always, you're welcome to join us. But please remember, if you're ever concerned about your health, don't just take our word for it. Also contact your doctor or visit your local health clinic for a professional diagnosis. Share your comments at 1-800-996-2848. Phone lines are open. On the line in San Francisco, California, is Dr. John Cox. He's an orthopedic surgeon specializing in hip and knee replacement. He is Navajo. Good morning, John. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
In Albuquerque, New Mexico, we have Ron Solomon. He's a business person from Laguna and Zuni Pueblos. Kwasi, Ron, and welcome, brother.
Hi, Uma. It's good to speak with you. Happy to be part of the program.
And joining us on Zoom is Dr. Megan Whitmarsh Brown. She's the Division Chief of Adult Hip and Knee Reconstructive Surgery at the University of New Mexico and an Assistant Professor of Orthopedics. Hello, Meg, and welcome.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Dr. Cox, John, I want to start with you today, and I've now reached that age where I can feel the effects of achy joints. Not a whole lot of fun. How common are orthopedic surgical procedures?
They're very common, especially with increasing age, since the topic is joint replacement. You know, across the U.S., musculoskeletal disease is the leading cause of disability. That includes, you know, low back pain, but also arthritis of joints. So it increases with age for a variety of reasons. So it is very common and one of the most common medical conditions leading to disability, particularly over the age of 65.
Now, outside of hips and knees, what other joints are most often replaced?
Probably the most common would be knees, followed by hips, then shoulder, then ankle. Then you can get replacements of other joints, particularly for fractures or rheumatoid arthritis of, you know, the elbow and wrist and fingers. But those are a little bit different, a little bit smaller scale. But elbow and wrist are pretty uncommon because there are other treatment options, including non-operative care is a little better tolerated. You can fuse the joints or do other options. So the most common ones are the bigger joints, you know, hip, knee, ankle, and shoulder.
So it sounds like joint replacement is kind of the last resort in the event of somebody who's got an issue with a joint. And at what point should someone start thinking about that possibility of having the entire joint replaced?
Yeah, that's very well said. The general approach that we advise our patients is that it should be the last line treatment because it's a very invasive procedure. It's considered a major surgery, and it has serious risks involved. So there's a lot of considerations that we go over with our patients. One is, you know, we really want to make sure everyone's tried conservative treatments before considering a pretty significant surgical intervention. We want to make sure they have severe arthritis and have impairments to the level that they would benefit from the surgery. So it's really a risk-benefit discussion. luckily for the majority of patients, the risks are fairly low. But it is one of those things that when they happen, it's pretty, it can be devastating. You know, infections of replaced joints are very, again, uncommon, but when they happen, they're a pretty devastating complication. Another consideration is, you mentioned age and survivorship of the implants are important to consider as well.
Okay. Well, you mentioned risk and you mentioned is that the primary risk then that infection could result after surgery, or are there other risks as well that people should be mindful of?
Yeah, there are major and minor risks, and the risks, we kind of think of them in terms of medical complications and then surgical complications. So medical complications are, you know, we're talking about risk of death is very low. You know, we try and screen for patients and optimize their health before going into elective surgery. So generally, it's like 0.1% or less, a very low rate of death from these particular things, and usually it's, you know, like a heart attack or cardiac event. So the more common ones, there's different rates, but 1% of the time you can get a blood clot, and a fraction of the time, about 0.2% of the time, that can travel to your lung and be a serious medical complication where it can potentially be a lethal complication. And then there are other minor things, you know, kidney failure or other injuries. So for the surgical side, the ones we worry about the most would be issues with the wound and infection. So infection nationwide is about a 1% rate, and there are certain risk factors that would bump that up. And the problem with infection is it's very hard to treat. It usually requires multiple surgeries, 2 months of IV antibiotics, and about a 15% recurrence rate. So it can be, and in certain populations that are more medically complex, it actually has similar rates of one-year mortality as certain cancers. So it can be really devastating. So we really do our best to optimize our patients and reduce that.
Yeah, that sounds really, really important. Well, let's talk more about age and how it factors into recovery.
Yeah, so it's a little bit of a balance. I have a discussion with my patients that generally we start the conversation of, there's no age cutoff per se, but the younger you are, we really want to make sure we're making the right decision because these implants don't last forever. We only know what we know. So we had a study done in 1995 that followed implants for 25 years. At 25 years, this is for both partial knee, and total hip, 25% had to be revised. They had to go back for more surgery. You know, the flip side of that is 75% were still functional. So it's pretty good longevity. Those are older techniques, older components. We're hoping we're doing better these days, and that number is, you know, the number of years you get out of the joint is going to be higher. But so if you're 50 years old, really interested in a joint replacement, there's a higher likelihood that you're going to need a second surgery at some point in time. So the earlier you do it, one, you have to live with the joint longer, and hopefully, and obviously we want it to positively impact your life, but you do have to think about it. One, if things go wrong, it's a longer period of time to live with that replacement. Say for instance, you don't like it or you have a complication, but also a higher rate of revision the younger you get it.
Yeah. Good information to know. Well, John, wear and tear, the wear and tear a body takes over the years. I mean, is that the main reason that patients come to see you needing joint replacement, or are there other factors that we should be talking about?
So nowadays, with the effective medical treatments of rheumatoid arthritis, that's less and less, at least in the general population. You know, it may be different at a referral center like University of New Mexico, but in the general community setting, it's, you know, what we call osteoarthritis or wear and tear. And the majority of that, you know, there are some risks, and we're learning more and more as time goes on, but there's definitely a genetic hereditary component. So if your parents had terrible arthritis and they had hip or knee replacements, there's a chance that you will follow in the same footsteps. But other things factor into it as well. Of course, age, the longer your joints are being used, trauma. So, and it's any kind of trauma, you know, it could be a major fracture or even just a meniscus tear while you're playing basketball. Those will predispose any kind of injury can culminate in severe arthritis and replacement down the road. Other risk factors like obesity, and we're learning more and more about metabolic syndrome and inflammation related to obesity. So it's not always just a mechanical wear problem, but we're still trying to understand how to lower that risk over time. And then some people have a genetic disadvantage in terms of a developmental problem like hip dysplasia, which tends to be at a much higher rate within Native communities. But in terms of what to do, it's not a one fit all thing. Mm-hmm. If you're a moderation runner, like you recreational run under a certain number of miles per week, you actually have a lower rate of developing arthritis than a non-runner. So, you know, resting it and not using it isn't really a great strategy. So, you know, that term wear and tear doesn't mean don't use it. We actually encourage you to stay mobile, stay strong, and be active as much as possible.
Okay.
The more competitive running, can change things, right? More competitive or more elite athletes are at higher risk of injury, so that would be a little different population.
Now, maintaining a healthy body weight sounds like that's one way to maintain good joint health. Also, exercise. What are some other activities or habits that people can undertake to just keep those joints healthy so they don't have to come visit you at some point, John?
Yeah. You know, to break it down, I think, you know, a lot of health is tied to diet, exercise, and mobility. So, again, stay active in something, whether it's, you know, stationary biking, walking your dog, do something every day to keep moving. There's developing research that, the less you do as you age, if you reach certain points where you're less active, it's really hard to gain that back. So it's really keeping active, keeping strong, finding a simple workout program and doing basic physical therapy exercises to keep your joints strong and well-coordinated, keeping the motion there. Is really pivotal, you know, to maintaining mobility and preventing surgery.
Healthy lifestyle sounds like good diet, being mobile, maintaining a healthy body weight. We're talking with Dr. John Cox. He is an orthopedic surgeon in San Francisco, California, and he's giving us insights. When we come back, we're going to talk more with Dr. Cox and our other guests. And if you've got a question with regard to joint replacement or joint health, give us a call, 1-800-99-NATIVE. The St. Regis Mohawk Tribe is working to get their judicial and legal documents readily available online. They say it's a way to improve justice for tribal members by increasing transparency. We'll hear from tribes putting a priority on accessing the information that affects people's lives on the next Native America Calling.
Cliche. February is American Heart Month. Protect your heart by eating healthy, staying active, and managing stress. Heart disease can run in families, so talk with elders about your family history. For more information, contact your local Indian healthcare provider, visit healthcare.gov, or call 1-800-318-2596. A message from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, El Aqua.
You are listening to Native America Calling. Today's topic, joint replacement. when to know if you might need the procedure, and what to expect during recovery. Have you ever gone under the knife to get a knee or hip replaced? How did it affect your life? We'd like to hear your story at 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. Our first guest, Dr. John Cox, he's in San Francisco, California, grew up in Gallup, New Mexico. And John, we've actually got a question here. This is a caller. That person didn't want to come on air, but here's what they have to say. They say, everything we're hearing sounds very scary. This is very concerning. What can we say to this person to make this process maybe a little bit less worrisome for somebody who might need joint replacement in the future?
Yeah, that's an excellent point. You know, I was actually thinking I was coming across as a little negative. So let's talk about the benefits that you get from joint replacement. So in terms of patient satisfaction for a hip replacement, it's 99% of people like it, would refer a friend, would do it again. For knees, it's 85%. So it's not as high, but it's still very high success rates. And overall, for a hip replacement, there's 1% revision rate at 10 years. So it's such a reliable procedure. And then when we're talking about what people get out of it, starting with hip replacement, people can expect to get back to normal. So it's a really remarkable procedure. And that plays into the discussion. So for knees, a little bit less so, right? For the majority of people, you're going to get back to your daily activities. I have some people getting back into, being tennis instructors and hiking mountains. People get back really high level of activity with both hip and knee replacements. And keep in mind, I said a lot of scary things, but it's less than a 1% for most of those. So those are very low rates. For the vast majority of people, it's going to provide a reliable outcome, more function, and carry a fairly low risk. You have to be conscious of the risk when you're making any decision, but just keep in mind those are low percentages. So yeah, it's not to scare anyone off, but it's something when you're making a decision, you should have, you know, both sides of the coin known.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that's good news. Good news, John. Yeah, I definitely want to make sure people don't get too scared here on our show, learning more about joint replacement, hips and knees and related joints like that. Let's talk to Ron now. Ron Solomon. He is in Albuquerque. And Ron, I've learned something new about you. I never knew that you had had both knees replaced. What was it that pushed you to see a specialist?
Pain. Plain and simple. Pain. It's pain in my joint.
Here we go. More scary stuff, Ron. Let's not scare all our listeners away.
If you've had to contemplate getting surgery or some treatment, course of treatment for the pain in your knees or your hip or whatever, there's a kind of a regimen that I went through. My personal experience is going to an orthopedic surgeon and initially getting some shots in my knees that really kind of tamed the pain that I was experiencing. And then talking with the orthopedic surgeon, I'm sure Dr. Cox and Meg, Dr. Meg, go through this process with their patients, but kind of advising them on what the progression of this might be, especially after they show you the x-rays or MRIs of your knee or shoulder, hip, whatever it is that's troubling you. And part of that starts off with some shots that help initially, and then you eventually get to a point where you really do need to go through the surgery. So I had two bad knees, and I had the choice of doing them at the same time and then having to go to a rehab center for a while, maybe a couple of weeks if I had both of them done. But I decided not to do that because I was so busy, and of course I'm still very busy in the business world. And so that protocol that I followed really helped me. And when I went through the surgery, the thing that, or the process that Dr. Cox was talking about in terms of screening, that has to do with a lot of laboratory kind of analysis to make sure that they know exactly where your glucose is, they know what your blood pressure is, and they didn't know if you have MRSA up your nose and things like that. Where so it's a laboratory process that you go through. That's not scary, but it's just a process that you go in anticipation of surgery. Then the actual day of surgery happens, and you go in, and eventually you're mildly sedated, and then you are sedated. And then you wake up, and you get offered things like popsicles and a cold drink of water and everything. So you get going right off the bat with some walking the day of the surgery. So I know it probably sounds impossible the way that some of our listeners are probably hearing this, but you actually get up and you walk, and then the next day maybe they have to demonstrate that you can climb a small set of stairs, maybe just one or two steps, and then you walk around the hospital ward that you're in, and then you're ready to go. So your physical therapy really starts the day of your surgery, at least in my case, and then was followed up by physical therapy that was outsourced to part of the medical practice that provided the care and then the surgery on my knees. So I've had both knees replaced, and let me tell you that it was a world of difference. Walking around, experiencing that pain, and I was advised by my son-in-law, who's an orthopedic surgeon, and my daughter, who's a physical therapist, about what this process was like. So maybe it's a little bit more intimate for me, and so I wasn't as, I wasn't put off by anything that the doctor said, because I kind of knew what they were going to be talking to me about. So it was a process that enabled me to continue my active life. And when I was a young kid on the res, I played res ball, both football and basketball. And then when our family moved into Albuquerque, then I played high school football and baseball again. And I incurred some injuries at that time, but nothing major, nothing that kept me out for too long. And somebody's mentioned way back then that, well, maybe someday when you're an old guy, you'll start to feel these things. So that, fortunately for me, I've lived a long life and actually had the experience or had to require surgery to put in a couple of replacements. So I did one, and probably about, it's been about 5 or almost 6 years ago. And then I had another one about 2 years ago. And so I have two knees that set off any kind of metal detector when I go to a basketball game or I go through TSA. Yeah. So I set them off. I always warn them. And so you have to go through a separate process. But
okay. Let me ask you, Ron. I mean, so you have two separate knee replacements. And do they both feel great? Or does one maybe feel a little better than the other?
Well, the first one, I did everything that I needed to in terms of post-surgery physical therapy. I had a great and wonderful PT that worked me through the whole process, stayed with me the entire time. The second time around, I got in a hurry, and I didn't complete my physical therapy the last two sessions, which really had to do with getting your balance back and creating more strength in your knees. And so I struggled a little bit more with that. If anybody's out there thinks that you can get the surgery, go home and sit down, that's absolutely the wrong thing to do. You've really got to stay active. So my process started with just some minor walks down the end of the block or down the end of the road and then back, and nothing major. I tended to want to show off that, oh yeah, I'm just completely well, so I can walk the usual mile or 2 miles or whatever it was. But that was the wrong thing to do too. So I developed a little bit of soreness when I wanted to get out there quickly.
Ron, you mentioned the metal apparatus there that's now your knee replacement and how you can trigger off metal detectors and things like that. What about, I hear people talking about like on cold days, they can feel the metal getting cold. Do you have any little side effects like that?
No, I don't. Have that kind of side effect. My understanding, doctors that are on the line, is that this is probably a titanium apparatus that I have in both knees or something of that nature. So it's not like having cold steel in your between your bones, your upper leg, and then the lower portion. Goes in and, you know, it just isn't something that has affected me that way. You know, the key thing, like the doctor, like Dr. Cox mentioned, is keeping moving. And that is a challenge with a lot of us desk jockeys sitting in front of computers, or if you just tend to have, you know, want to be a couch potato, that's kind of absolutely the wrong thing to do. And I've learned that the hard way, you know, so I try to follow my wife's example, which is, you know, to make sure you get up at least every hour, especially when I have a 4-hour session of, you know, being on the computer on Zoom calls or whatever it is, to get up and move around. I like to dance, and that has that's been compromised somewhat, you know, for me with the two operations I had. I used to love running too. I used to run around the North Golf Course here in Albuquerque, you know, maybe, I don't know, 2 or 3 times, and that was no problem. But as time went along, I was warned against that pounding. So I'm a bike rider more than I am a runner nowadays.
Yeah, just not so much pounding, right, Ron? Riding a bike?
Right.
Yeah.
That's it. Yeah.
Appreciate it, Ron. This is really helpful, and I'm learning a lot more about you. I knew you played football. I remember once talking to you about that, so it's good to know.
Yeah.
But yeah, appreciate it. Let's move on now to Dr. Meg, as you described her. And Meg, let's talk a little bit about Native patients that you work with. And do you have a lot of folks coming in with out-of-town referrals suffering from joint issues?
We do. So I'm at the University of New Mexico. Our joint replacement center moved from downtown Albuquerque to the Rio Rancho area. So we have quite a few referrals coming from all over New Mexico, but also from Eastern Arizona, Southern Colorado, and West Texas coming in, as anyone who's familiar with the area, which I think everyone on the call is. There's not a lot of major hospital centers in the Southwest. You kind of have to go to one of several places in the kind of Four Corners area. So we do see quite a few people coming all the way, even from Fort Defiance, Gallup, Shiprock area, coming down to see us, as well as the closer areas to Albuquerque. We do see quite a lot of advanced joint disease in our patients who are coming from those areas. And I think, as the news kind of referenced earlier on the program, a lot of that is because our state and our area does not necessarily have a very large primary care network for health. So we see people at a little bit later stage of their arthritis process than when you're in a kind of a major city. I trained in Los Angeles and Texas and moved here, so people would come in a little earlier.
Now, Meg, how big a problem is that, getting these more late stage issues with arthritis? Would it be better if you could get those patients sooner?
So I think that's a little bit of a double-edged sword. There's certainly, so one thing I always tell people is, you know, we worry about the wear and tear, right? When folks come in, they say, oh, am I going to, a lot of people ask, well, if I don't do the surgery now, am I going to hurt myself? Is this going to be a problem if I keep wearing it out? And I think what I tell most of my patients is, for the vast majority of the time, you know, shy of a major accident on a motorcycle or something like that, wearing the joint out further is not necessarily going to change what we do surgically. For these kind of end of the road arthritis patients, we kind of have one hammer to hit the nail with, which is a hip replacement or a knee replacement. And so it's not necessarily a technical problem. There are certainly cases with folks who, as John alluded to earlier, have developmental dysplasia or certain types of very advanced knee changes that change the alignment of their leg that affects kind of the soft tissue around the knee, that can make surgery more challenging. But at the end of the day, we're replacing the bone with metal, so mm-hmm. we can do that no matter what.
All right. Well, Meg, you know, comments like one hammer to hit the nail, I don't know if you're going to alleviate any fears of someone.
I know.
Let's talk a little bit more about what's being replaced. Like, for example, with a knee replacement, what types of materials are you using? And is it like the entire knee that's replaced? How does that all work?
It's a great question. So knee replacements and hip replacements are, I think of them as slightly different. A knee replacement really is kind of more of a resurfacing operation. So essentially what happens is we make a cut through the front of the skin and we remove the kind of bumpy potholed surface of the cartilage that's been worn down through the arthritis process, usually over many years. And then when we have kind of a smooth bone surface, we're able to place essentially two metal caps. They're typically titanium, like Ron mentioned, or some kind of a titanium alloy that will become the new end cap for the femur, which is the thigh bone, and the tibia, which is the shin bone. And then we put a very, very strong piece of plastic in between. And that plastic kind of serves like the new cartilage surface that allows the knee to rotate smoothly around itself. We aren't replacing the muscles or the ligaments that crisscross the knee. And so that's kind of why physical therapy is so, so important, especially after a knee replacement. What I try and remind patients is the knee, as Ron kind of mentioned, you can still get soreness in the knee because muscles can get sore and tired. Tendons can get tendonitis. So those kind of pesky soft tissue problems can still persist after a knee replacement, but the kind of gnawing, aching, deep bone pain should be gone because that bone surface has been resurfaced itself.
Now,
the hips, sorry, go
okay,
ahead.
No, go ahead. No, we're listening. Yeah.
The hip is slightly different. I kind of think of the hip as more of a true replacement. When we're doing a hip replacement, we talk about the hip being a ball and socket joint. We're actually removing the ball from that joint. So that's the top of the femur bone. And we remove that from the body that's often deformed. And that's kind of, instead of having a nice smooth round surface that's rolling around in your hip, it's kind of gnarled and bumpy, and it kind of causes that catching, gnawing pain that people feel often in their groin or even deep in their buttock sometimes. So that is more of a true replacement. We then resurface the socket part of the bone, which is a special area of the pelvic bone called the acetabulum. So we place a typically titanium liner inside the bone, and then inside the femur is often either it's titanium or what we call cobalt chrome, different types of metal stem inside the femur that then is connected through, again, another very, very strong piece of plastic that acts like the new cartilage surface. And in those situations, especially for our patients here in Albuquerque, some patients do want to have that bone back. There's more bone to remove. And so that is something to be mindful of, I think, for patients who are coming in, if they're going to want to ask for that back ahead of time.
All right. More with Dr. Meg and our other guests when we come back from this break.
Are you a Native American healthcare provider, recovery counselor, social worker, domestic and sexual abuse advocate, or traditional healer working in Native American communities? Dr. Ruby Gibson will begin an advanced immersion in healing historical trauma. This online masterclass in somatic archaeology uses the lens of a seven-generational recovery approach, providing powerful modalities, and is offered tuition-free to tribal members. Registration deadline is March 1st. Info at freedomlodge.org. Who support this show?
Said goodbye, cleared out in record time. Rumors like big dark clouds had been circling around, a rumble here, a rumble there, a heavy feeling in the air. What you gonna do when the rain comes down? There's a hole in the roof, hole in the town, hole in the town where the jobs disappear. Nobody can find one anywhere. Judgment Day, the roof blew almost off with the news. For years of work, staying late, the company showed us the gate. Looking high, looking low for a job, where'd they go? The next day, the next week, I wonder how we're gonna eat.
What you gonna do when the rain comes down? There's a hole in the roof.
This is Native America calling. I'm Sean Spruce, and we're talking about joint health and replacement. One major barrier Native people face is the distance needed to travel to access this pain-relieving procedure. If you've had knee or hip replacement surgery and you had to travel for an orthopedic doctor, let us know. Get on the phone right now. Call us, 1-800-996-2848. Tell us how far you had to travel and what that experience was like. Joint replacement surgery. That's the focus of our show today, and your questions are always welcome. 1-800-996-2848. And on the line right now, we have Dr. Megan Whitmarsh Brown. And Meg, you just described joint and hip replacement and how some of the materials, the plastics and the titanium, are, of course, man-made, but then you use some of the existing ligament and muscle tissue. I'm also curious, what about donor parts? Do joint replacements ever call for donor parts being replaced?
So for the vast majority of time, no, we don't necessarily have to use donor parts. In certain cases with kind of more complex, long-standing disease processes, for example, sometimes for folks who have significant changes in their bony anatomy from dysplasia, and more commonly, if we're doing, as John mentioned before, a revision surgery, which is the second time around joint replacement. So something's gone wrong, we have to remove the components and put new ones back in. Those are the situations where sometimes we will use bone graft, which is cadaver graft that's very carefully cleaned and is donated from patients. But it goes through a very strict sterilization process, and occasionally we will need to use that. But with more modern implant designs, and especially with the materials that we use now, we often are able to use what we call porous metals that kind of act like bone. So they're not completely solid, and the bone can actually grow into those metals to fill gaps that in the past we would need to use donor bone graft for.
Now, what about patients that might request bone fragments or cartilage back for cultural reasons? Is that common and is that possible?
So I would say it varies patient to patient. I think it's a little bit more challenging in knees because it's more of a resurfacing and those fragments are quite small and a little bit difficult to collect. For hips, when we remove that ball part of the ball and socket joint, that usually is something that can be saved. However, I would say here in New Mexico, do have the capability to provide those pieces back to patients. We do need to know about it ahead of time so that the bone can be cleaned and preserved and returned safely to the patient. In other states, it may vary, and at different institutions, that can vary. And so depending on what area of the country you're in, I would certainly check with your provider before the surgery if that's something that's important. I would say probably about 1 in 4 of our patients, at least at UNM, do ask for some of those parts back.
Meg, what about cost? And, you know, hopefully people have adequate medical insurance, but I'm just curious, what is like a typical knee replacement or hip replacement? What's the cost in that?
So that's a very interesting and loaded question for the joint replacement community right now. So I think a lot of people think it's probably around something like $20,000 to $30,000 or more. But what we actually get reimbursed, so the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, which is the federal kind of healthcare governing body, reimburses about $1,200 for a hip or knee replacement. So on the surface, the actual joint replacement itself, the pieces, depending on where you buy them from, are anywhere from a couple $1,000s on up. For the patient, it's incredibly variable. And that is something that we are fighting for as a community too. AAKIS, which is the American Association of Hip and Knee Surgeons, has an advocacy branch that does want to keep this surgery cost effective and affordable for patients because we know that there's such a large demand out there. And so we advocate on behalf of the society but also on our patients to the federal government to ensure that changes in how the government is sort of subsidizing these don't make it impossible for us to keep providing these surgeries, especially in rural areas like New Mexico, where our resources are already somewhat more limited than, say, you know, New York, Washington, and Austin.
Thanks, Meg. That's really helpful. Let's go to the phones now. We have Jennifer, who is listening on KUNM in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Hello, Jennifer. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
You bet. You bet. Now.
Yeah, I'm non-native. I love this show. I've listened for years. I've had both hips replaced and actually a small spinal surgery, osteoarthritis. I'm 71 now. And just really briefly, you know, what led to it was was pain. I've always been really athletic. Really athletic. And pain, I couldn't reach my feet to clip my toenails. It was just, I was in agony, and it was getting worse. And it was sudden. It came on pretty fast. So I had a small spinal surgery. It was rough, but it seems to have worked really well. I got my first hip replaced down in Texas. And I swore I'd never go through that again. And then I really, really, I was, my right hip said, no, you got to replace me too. So I did the second one up here. I moved back up here. And, I would say that people say it's an easy surgery. It's not. For me, it was brutal, but worth it. And, and each hip was done by a different doctor with a different technique. So the downside is that, I don't have the same walk. I have leg length discrepancy. It's like I got one hip at Walmart and the other one at Target, and they don't quite match, but it's still worth it. Big key, and Ron was saying this, is to work out. It's to get right up and do what you can every single day, and I do that. And it's been, 3 years now since I finished all that, and I'm very active. I go to the gym a lot. I'm going to start taking dance classes. I can't teach anymore, but it's like it's so worth it, even though it's really rough.
All right.
And that's all I got to say. You know, make sure you stay, get active after this, and actually work out before the surgery if you can. Work up for it.
Jennifer, thank you for calling in, and I'm happy that your hip replacements have worked out for you. Let's go back to Dr. John Cox. And John, Jennifer describes now having legs of different height. How common is that?
That's actually probably the most common leg length discrepancy, the most common complaint or complication after a hip replacement. But it's a little bit different for a variety of reasons. Like, for instance, I would certainly expect, I tell my patients to expect a difference of a few millimeters. And if you look at a few millimeters, it's a very small difference. Most people won't notice. When it gets, 5 millimeters to 1 centimeter different, you're going to notice, and it could, be symptomatic and problematic for you. So it is common, but most of the time, at least in majority of my patients, it's within 5 millimeters, which isn't very noticeable. And to her point, she was talking about different techniques. So there's multiple different approaches to the hip joint. One is posterior, one is anterior. A lot of discussion in our community about that, pros and cons of each. Certain methods to track your leg length can be employed. And I would say most of the time it's very accurate. It is common, but it's certainly not the majority.
And all right.
I would say the rationale for that is we have implants in multiple different sizes. We have to make bone cuts. We have to make those implants with fixed parameters work within your hip, and to prevent, I'm going to say another scary word, but to prevent hip dislocating. So if the hip pops out of socket, again, we have lower and lower rates over time of that complication. But sometimes in surgery, you have to make the leg further away from the hip, further away from the pelvis. And so, it's geometry. So the further you push the hip away to make it more stable, the leg length will increase by a few millimeters each change you make. So that's why it happens. But usually it's not noticeable in the vast majority of cases.
All right. And John, please put our listeners at ease. You don't buy your knee replacements from Walmart, do you?
No, no. We, you know, it's very difficult to get a hip implant approved by the FDA. So the majority of surgeons use very well-established companies. You know, the big names, Zimmer, Biomet, DePuy, Stryker, they've been in the game for decades. They make really good implants. A lot of research goes into it. A lot of testing goes into it. But that is something to ask your surgeon about. You know, what do they use? How long have they been using it? Does it have a good track record? And most surgeons really want to reduce the risk and variability case to case. And so they'll choose a reliable implant with a very good track record to minimize any chances going wrong. But these are very safe implants that have been around for a very long time.
All right. That's good to know. Ron, back to you. And let's talk a little bit about, you know, before you made the decision to have your knees replaced and how you weighed your options. And also, did you talk to different surgeons and get differing opinions before making the final decision?
Well, Sean, like I mentioned, and Doctors Cox and Brown, I'm fortunate to have two people in my family. One is my son-in-law, who practices out in Prescott, Arizona, and my daughter, who's his wife, and she's a physical therapist. So I had some great resources, you know, to chat with and to kind of get a feel for where I was at. And of course, sometimes in our visits to them out in Arizona, I would be rubbing my knee, and like for no obvious reason. And then my son-in-law would ask, what's happening? And so I'd say, well, you know, I got the pain right here. It's a little sharp and stuff. And so, you know, he would just, you know, kind of work with me on that. And we talked through this, you know, kind of well before I actually went through the surgery. So, and then, you know, that was one aspect. And then the other aspect was having a daughter that's also a former athlete, or still is an athlete, but, and she had different kinds of injuries that really kind of earmarked that profession for her as something that she might want to get into. And so she did pursue it. So between the two of them, you know, they were great advisors to me. And so I didn't shop around or do anything. I, you know, had pretty good surgeon that I had utilized in the past. And so, and then the PAs and everybody that work with the doctors are really good advisors too. They are the ones that spend a good amount of time just kind of talking you through where you're at in the process, especially as you're getting ready for surgery. They're the ones that perform some of the tests that and they explain it to you. So that's the kind of sort of backdrop for my decisions to move forward, and then the subsequent advice and assistance that I got from people that are in the medical practice there. So it wasn't solely the doctors that were there. You know, they're the ones that helped me to, you know, see where the issues were when I was bone to bone, like say on my knees. So that they were critical, I think, in my decision making.
That's really helpful, Ron. Thanks for those insights. And Meg, for our listeners, unlike Ron, who might not have a doctor in the family, what advice can you give for somebody who's looking for a good orthopedic surgeon?
I think that's a really good question. It's very hard, even for folks in the medical community, to find a doctor outside their specialty. Sometimes it can feel like you're just going on Google for, as you know, as the last caller mentioned, something from Target. And obviously we don't want you feeling that way. So my recommendations, especially when you're considering a joint replacement, there are two major things. I always recommend whoever your surgeon is, be what we call an arthroplasty fellowship trained surgeon. So all of us, Dr. Cox and myself, who go through orthopedic training, we do 5 years of general orthopedics, and then you have an opportunity to do an additional year of training in a subspecialty area. So those of us who do specifically hip and knee replacements do what's called an arthroplasty fellowship. And in a lot of our data, as Dr. Cox had mentioned, you know, we argue within the field about the best approaches and the best implants, but what our research shows over and over again is surgeons who do these surgeries almost exclusively as their primary job, you know, they're doing 80% or more of their surgeries are hip and knee replacements, are going to have fewer complications and better what we call patient reported outcomes, or better outcomes from a patient's perspective. So how their pain and their activity level improve. So that's number one, is arthroplasty fellowship trained surgeon. And number two, you got to like the person. I think to Ron's point, you know, having a really good staff that you trust and explains things well to you, but also that you trust your surgeon, you feel comfortable asking questions, you don't feel like you're being sold a surgery, that you're in the driver's seat, I think is very important to just have the best experience going through your surgery as possible.
Well, Meg, really appreciate you coming on the show today and sharing your knowledge and expertise along with Dr. John Cox. And of course, we had Ron Solomon, who shared his experiences of having both of his knees replaced. And with that, we are out of time now, so we're going to have to wrap up the show. And please join us here on Native America Calling next week. We'll have another lineup of discussions, starting out with a conversation about technology to improve access to tribal law knowledge. Our executive producer is Art Hughes. Our producers are Andy Murphy and Sol Traverso. Marino Spencer is the engineer. Thanks again to Roman Garcia. Sho McPolin is the digital producer. Nola Daves Moses is the distribution director. Bob Peterson is the network manager for Native Voice One. Clifton Chadwick is our national underwriting sales director. Antonia Gonzalez is the anchor for National Native News. Charles Sather is our chief operations officer. The president and CEO of Quantic Broadcast Corporation is Jacqueline Salee. Have a safe weekend. I'm Sean Spruce.
Support by Archaeology Southwest. Did you know almost all major archaeological sites in the Southwest have been looted or vandalized? Looting and vandalism impact Indigenous people, past, present, and future. Every day, countless Native American cultural items are lost or damaged forever through looting and vandalism. Federal and tribal laws protect archaeological resources. More information about ending archaeological resource crime and how to submit a tip at savehistory.org and on social media at savehistory.
Yat'e. February is American Heart Month. Protect your heart by eating healthy, staying active, and managing stress. Heart disease can run in families, so talk with elders about your family history. For more information, contact your Indian health care provider. Visit healthcare.gov or call 1-800-318-2596. A message from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. Ahiha.
Native America Calling is produced in the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico, by Quantic Broadcast Corporation, a Native nonprofit media organization. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from the Public Radio Satellite Service. Music is by Brent Michael Davids. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.